Hello, everyone. Well, I'm getting a finger. Wait, all right, we got the thumbs up.
We are live.
We are now live. It is Wednesday, March 20th, 2024.
So it is.
As you can tell, we are not in our usual setup. It is much more evident that I am shorter than Drew. My laptop is out. We're laid back today.
Absolutely.
We're so chill.
Relaxed.
We're so relaxed. If you took like my pulse right now, it'd be at a cool 20.
Yeah. Just
hibernating.
lowering the heart rate. Taking about 3 breaths a minute.
I'm trying to conserve my energy.
Yeah.
I'm getting ready to go to space.
Yeah.
No, I'm not. Savannah, our dearest reporter here at CUTV, is feeling under the weather, and it has sort of thrown a wrench in the works for the episode we had planned. But like troopers, we're here to keep the show running.
The show, as they say, must go on.
The show, as they say, must go on. Absolutely.
And we have some excellent topics lined up.
Absolutely. So obviously, as if you could not tell by his beautiful voice, we have Drew Oyaje back on. Publisher of The Breach, executive director at CUTV. What are some other titles we can throw your way?
Sometimes research coordinator at SEAS.
Sometimes research coordinator at SEAS.
Yep.
Father. Dog owner. Trying to make it relatable here.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like Mark Zuckerberg, I just got to like find the most awkward way to throw in some reference to the fact that I'm actually a human being.
I have blood. Yeah. I, like everyone else, have blood. Good job, Mark. You're doing great. Yeah, so the topics we have today. Honestly, it's like I'm happy we're talking about these because I think there has been kind of like a flood of really interesting Montreal-specific news.
Absolutely.
Going on. Okay, so I guess to talk about today's agenda, we are going to be talking about the strike happening in Mirabel by people who are part of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, members of the local 712 division up in Mirabel working for Airbus. They're going on strike. So we're going to kind of get into what that strike is about.
Yeah, let's do it.
A sort of... Yeah, I guess just this all the... Because when I heard about that strike, I was like, oh, cool, strike. Let's see what it's about. And there's a lot of interesting currents, I think, that the strike is sort of in the middle of. I think it's a labor issue, but it's also kind of an issue of government policy and capitalism, as we so often discover.
There are some major global themes playing out in the strike. Oh, but yeah. Let's introduce the other topics before I go on a tangent.
Thank you, Drew, for stopping yourself. we have Valerie Plante, the beautiful mayor of Montreal. I'm trying to do a Trump.
She's worried.
She's worried. She's concerned.
Yeah. She has concerns.
She's worried and she has concerns about the Quebec public transit budget.
Yeah. She says the lack thereof.
Exactly. The lack thereof. It's sort of not impressive, but I guess we're not too surprised that anything.
Yeah.
Getting into why the CAC not really giving too much money to public transit makes sense and is sort of par for the course. And then talking about par for the course, talk about golf. People who love to go golfing, real estate developers.
Excellent segue. I love it.
Thank you. We've talked about this in the past, but Montreal is a sort of a 2020 thing.
Yeah.
They have a lot of kind of incentives and ways to try to get developers to produce more, build more affordable social housing. It's not really worked. One of those tools is this sort of, not quite a fine, but it's like a...
Yeah.
It's like the deal is like, hey, if you're building something, part of it needs to be social or affordable housing, and if not, you have to give us money. And now they are dismantling that.
Yeah. Well, and we'll find out why.
Yeah, and we'll find out why.
At the bottom of the show.
At the end of the show. So that's sort of our show today, folks. Yeah, thank you for listening, and yeah, let's get into it. The Mirabel Airbus strike. So On Sunday, workers there were given a... They've sort of been without contract since end of February. Oh. They're sort of given a proposed contract that would have provided exactly a 10% raise over 3 years.
Yeah. So assuming that inflation might be a little higher than 3.3%.
Yeah.
Chances are
it's not really going away. So
you're not catching up with the last 3 years, but yeah, and then you're also falling probably short of the next 3 years. So
here's a few quarters for you guys making our incredibly expensive
plans. A de facto pay cut. To be sure.
Exactly. Yeah, a pay cut in real terms. I think mm-hmm. the economists would call it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously the workers there were not happy. And so they've voted on the strike. I think it was a very high percentage of votes, something like 80% or more voted to strike. There's been some actions Sunday, immediately on Tuesday as well. Since then, apparently in the union memo, they told the workers that Airbus has sort of changed their tone in negotiations. The news of it kind of broke worldwide, naturally, given that Airbus is this big mm-hmm. French company. A lot of people always have their eyes on the aerospace aerospace field. Affects a lot of people.
So can I jump into it?
Please.
There are two big pieces of context here that I think are really important. There's, for starters, you have Boeing, which is the crown jewel of the U.S. aerospace industry. Yeah.
They call it a duopoly, right? It's either between Airbus or Boeing that sort of like dominate the market.
Apparently China's looking to make it a triopoly. But they're not... They're not quite there yet. So, it really is a global sort of, in terms of commercial airlines, it really is between Airbus and Boeing. And as you've probably heard, Boeing has been having some issues with its planes lately.
To put it lightly.
It's one thing to have like... popping off in mid-flight.
It's one thing to be like, my car is having issues. Yeah. It's another thing where the plane is kind of like not really working.
Yeah, let's get into a metal tube, go up into the... thousands of feet into the air and just see if things work. We can always pull over to the side. No, wait, I guess I guess there's no service station up here.
You can't really call CAA or
no. It's pretty much you're flying with what you got. So long story short, doors are popping off, landing gear is failing, all these issues are happening with Boeing. And that basically stems from shareholder capitalism. I mean, you basically have a situation where for the last few decades, Boeing has been like, to the extent that they moved their headquarters from Seattle, where they actually have factories, to Chicago, where they don't, for the explicit purpose of having their administrative decisions be further away and not, imbricated in their engineering decisions so that they could better implement cost-cutting measures, streamlining, as it were, and basically making as many profits as possible by cutting costs. And now we're seeing the results of that, just catastrophic results. And they're squandering a almost century-old reputation at this point. Mm. They used to have T-shirts that said, "If it ain't Boeing, I'm not going." That was a reference to their safety reputation, especially
now. If it's Boeing, I'm not going.
Especially relative to the McDonnell Douglas DC-10, which was fraught, shall we say, with issues when it was a commercial airliner. The Boeing acquired McDonnell Douglas, relatively recently, and seems to have taken all the wrong lessons from that merger. Their planes are falling apart. And of course, who's the main beneficiary of that? That's Airbus.
The one other player.
Yeah, exactly.
Airbus is incredibly well positioned to kind of benefit off this.
And so they're anticipating, I would have to imagine, if not already seeing, a brisk business in orders for their A220. And the other piece of context, which I will tell you about in a second because you have something to say.
Yeah, thank you. I think there's one thing I want to note too, is like Airbus is well positioned for this, not only because there's like to connect it back to Montreal, not only because they're sort of like just the other player, but the specific kind of model of Boeing plane, the 737, it's kind of like one of the, it's like an aging part of a lot of like airline systems, right? So it's been around so long. And part of the issues is this thing where it's like, it's getting old, right? It's just like, it's coming to like wear and tear, and they're trying to like kind of keep it in like, in service, but it's clearly like, it's come at a great cost to safety over profits. Great cost to safety in pursuit of profits, in pursuit of keeping that plane, whatever, like running as long as possible. Airbus has a model of plane called the A220, and that was made to be the sort of inheritor or the replacement for 737s. They're anticipating that it would be that it was kind of like it's reaching a certain age that it's going to need the. Airlines are going to want sort of smallish aircraft that are like 110 to 150 seats. These are not usually
significantly more efficient.
Exactly. Yeah. What's interesting is that one of the progenitors of the A220 was sort of like billed as like the most fuel efficient plane, right? Mm-hmm. The 737, the Airbus A220, they're sort of like 110, 150 seats, single aisle. It's like one of those classic like, three seats on one side, two seats on the other side, and Airbus makes those in two places: Mirabel, just 45 minutes north of Montreal, and Mobile, Alabama.
Wow!
The Montreal one, I think they produce like 10 a month, but clearly Airbus is expecting much more orders. They've announced just a few weeks ago that there's sort of at least at the Mirabel production facility, they're sort of trying to ramp up production to 14 planes a month. So yeah, they're in.
So congratulations to the workers in Mirabel. For taking advantage of their position.
They knew the leverage that they have.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Yeah, they knew kind of the position they're in. They knew the position of the company, and they know that they are gonna get the short end of the stick. You're gonna say something. Sorry, continue.
Well, there's just some really interesting context here, which is that the A220 is actually. Formerly the C series, is that right?
This is correct.
Yeah,
this is correct. So it's
so this is actually
a homegrown.
Yeah, a major feat of Canadian engineering, but also subsidies. So yeah. Significant subsidies have been put into, what was originally the Bombardier C series. Mm-hmm. Bombardier itself being an interesting example. They've received. Billions in subsidies going back to the 60s, propping up their business. And they recently sold off their commercial airline business, which is basically this plane, which wasn't doing very well, but it now is the toast of the commercial aerospace market somehow, now that Airbus has taken it up. Yeah.
So we have this like homegrown project, the C series by Bombardier, which was sort of like always like, there's this dream of it being sort of of Bombardier being able to break into this kind of duopoly that Airbus and Boeing has. And it's gotten incredible amounts of money from Quebec, from Canada. Never really was profitable. Mm-hmm. But even then, what's interesting is like Airbus, they bought the Bombardier stake. The whole purchase acquisition of it is its own story. But it still remains unprofitable. I think the company is thinking that it's going to be unprofitable until 2026 or 20. Even some estimates have it at 2030. Right?
Which is why they're eager to depress wages.
Exactly. Exactly.
To speed that up. Always speed up that profitability breaking point.
No, exactly. Yeah. That's precisely it.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to maximize shareholder value. So that's one piece of the history. But then another piece is that Bombardier, started in the mid-century. I was going to do that, but I was worried about the squeak.
It was a laid-back episode.
Bombardier started mid-century because, the guy who invented the snowmobile, basically. Yes, but then they got into all kinds of other businesses. But they've basically been selling off probably the number one and two most socially relevant businesses after having, accepted an estimated $4 billion in subsidies over the years.
You're telling me they sold off their Ski-Doo department?
I'm telling you that they sold off their first. Well, the most socially relevant one would be, you know, their train division, yeah, which they sold off to a French company called Alstom just in 2021. But then, yeah, obviously their commercial airline business has also been sold off and is now this.
What are they doing?
You know, now an Airbus. And what are they doing now? Now they're making corporate jets.
That's great. That's great that we. Yeah. That's great that governments have sunk just lots of public money, yeah, into just the corporate jet factory.
really helpful. Yeah. Yeah. Private jets. Definitely what we need more of in the, 2020s. Mm-hmm. The roaring 2020s, as it were.
Everyone's going to have their own private jet. It's going to be like the Ford Model T, you know?
Absolutely.
I guess that's kind of what Taylor Swift is doing, I guess. She's doing that private jet to one side of the city to another. I'm sure people like her are going to appreciate the...
yeah, well, I don't know. I think Taylor Swift seems to have acquired her private jet, so I don't know. Well, it'll be the new layer of billionaires and trillionaire and multimillionaires, hundred millionaires, who come out of the latest enlightened economic policies of our fearless leaders.
Who will be
buying?
I was calling them scams and pyramid schemes.
People who bought Bitcoin early, will now be people who bought the dip. will be buying high and flying high, as it were. So that's another piece. But I feel like just to focus on the Airbus piece, Quebec still has a stake of about $1 billion.
Yes. So I'm happy you brought that up. So in the initial investments in the C series, Quebec invested something like $1 billion also into the program, into developing like this own like homegrown. Made in Quebec kind of plane that could potentially. The real thing is it does employ like a lot of people. I think Bombardier employs something like 2,500 people. Although of course that number has been lessening.
The number quoted by the government was that 3,300 jobs would stay in Quebec as a result of this investment.
There you go. So $1 billion for that, and they also made recently another $300 million investment into this program, into the A220 program, because they were wanting to keep the proportion of their share at 25%, because Airbus was going to do another round of like financing, and because of that, there was of course their portion was going to balloon. So Quebec wanted to make sure that their piece of the pie stayed at 25%. Quebec was supposed to exit their position 2025, but it's been pushed back to 2030 still. They're expecting Fitzgibbons, Minister was saying that it should be profitable by then, but I mean things are looking like it could still be. But I mean, there's a lot of public money in this program.
So I will say this is not a corporate jet. This is not as socially execrable as a corporate jet is.
No. So this this is not just for your suited class.
This is something that middle class people would ride. That said, it is a smaller. Mostly short haul could go transatlantic, but mostly short haul, mostly domestic. It's mostly being used for domestic flights. So Qantas, I think, bought a number of these.
JetBlue as well.
JetBlue bought some, and so they do mostly domestic flights. And in this at this late date in climate change, mitigation strategies. I think it's pretty clear. It's not. It's rarely spoken by anybody because it's hard to say these things out loud because nobody's saying them. But we should be phasing out short haul flights completely. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have airplanes flying around, especially when we have the technology to create high speed rail networks. That could replace short haul flights, that could replace domestic flights altogether. Mm-hmm. Within our lifetimes, certainly within the next two decades, if we were very ambitious about it. And we should have started doing that, back when the Kyoto Protocol was signed.
Naturally.
But we didn't. Yeah. So now we have to do it even faster.
And what's interesting is Bombardier has offered also help to other countries, like they help China develop their own like high speed trains.
There you go.
Yeah, so it's like it's not like we lack the kind of like technological know how here.
Well, we had the technological know how, and then we sold it to France. So
right now we have the technological know how to make corporate jets.
Exactly. very, very valuable. Yeah. So I guess, a good use of $4 billion, certainly. Right. Yeah.
So I guess it's to point out that here Quebec is, I'm just looking at the A220 project alone, we have like $1.3 billion American invested in that.
Exactly.
From Quebec alone, right? And it's like, could that money have been used for other things? Could that money have been used for public infrastructure projects? Or public transit projects,
for example, and even if we limit it to say like, okay, we should invest that in a private company, does it need to be a private for-profit company that does all kinds of silly things like build corporate jets? I would say, like, you know, there's an alternate history where we say, okay, how, like, we have a theoretical $4 billion in subsidies, how are we going to invest that? Why not create some kind of quasi private institution that builds useful things, and that creates open source plans for trains, for example, that brings together like researchers from all the universities and creates open source models for high speed rail, for all kinds of climate friendly infrastructure and technology. Gives that away to the third world, to the rest of the world that obviously we cannot follow our development model because it's so fossil fuel intensive, but you know, creates a quality of life, creates socially useful infrastructure, and then build those things, and compete in the global market, for providing those actual, the physical things, what all these union members, the machinists and all these people who have this, are highly trained and can build these precision parts, and do this sort of capital intensive construction work, put them to work. I think, and that could make, Canada or Montreal or whoever's giving the subsidies into a global leader in, climate friendly tech. And that would be an amazing economic development opportunity. It would create a lot of jobs. It would create a lot of soft power, even if you want to look at it from a foreign policy perspective. But that's the route that we did not choose.
Right.
That as early as the like late 80s. Could have, like, anybody with, like, who's reading some of the papers that are being put on their desk, any leader could see what was coming. And oil companies knew in the 60s what was happening. So, like, our political leaders should have known. I think we're pretty clear by the 80s, but they didn't do it. And so now we've put $4 billion in subsidies into a private jet business and sold off all the most socially useful and valuable stuff to France, basically.
Back in 2017, you wrote an article about nationalizing Bombardier.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious, what do you think? I feel like you're touching on some of those kinds of like key points, right, about having these, like, having so many sets. And this is to say, this is not only Bombardier. Like, we see this in so many different industries. Like the main one that comes to my mind is like telecoms, right? Like we have all this public money that's put into literally setting up the infrastructure that then we just hand over the keys to like these companies for. I'm kind of curious about this kind of, I do think there is this kind of like really, there's this great utility in having this kind of like, I guess like in, not quite in-house, but like like locally available, this local labor population that we can draw upon their intelligence on these kinds of issues to build these things here, right? Not to have to rely on like other countries for that.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, what's changed, you think, about this pitch to nationalize Bombardier since 2017 when you wrote that piece?
Well, for one, they sold off all their relevant and useful things. So it's nationalizing a private jet business. At the point that it's only a private jet business, or maybe they make some like four wheelers or something, but at that point, it's time to shut it down. Mm-hmm. It's like cut your losses.
Retool it, maybe.
Yeah, you could retool it. You could, you can certainly put the private jet infrastructure, but yeah, you're talking about some overhead. You have to invest, so it's hard. Mm-hmm. But certainly, yeah, there's relevant skill sets there. But you're talking about an overhaul that's going to take years. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Yeah, you shouldn't shut it down. We should retool it. And this is the same thing with all the arms manufacturers that are the sort of quiet mainstay of mm-hmm. Canada's economy. I mean, even right here in Laval, you've got people making landing gear for F-35s that are, you know, bombing kids in Gaza. Like these are not socially useful things, but they could be. Those people could relatively easily be retrained to do stuff that we actually do need, which is, you know, creating, light rail infrastructure in Gaza, for example.
I think General Dynamics has a factory of like 2 hours north of Montreal where they make like Bullet Tornado. And I guess it's interesting to think about the kind of like, I guess the after the nationalization mm-hmm. of these kind of companies, if that were to happen, how are they retooled? How do we kind of use that kind of like engineering know-how?
I mean, I think we have to expand our imaginations. So at the high level, it's not straightforward. Right. But I think what you do is you hand it over to, you empower the workers as much as possible, and you give them a socially responsible mandate, and you mm-hmm. say, okay, let's, you know, we've been dilly-dallying for 50 years now. It's time to put our talents to work building the most climate-friendly tech possible. And so I would say just give them like a 10-year window where it's like, okay, we're phasing in worker control, we're phasing in a green mandate. Mm-hmm. We are, you know, building links with nonprofit institutions like universities globally as well as in Canada. Mm-hmm. We're mobilizing the sort of, you know, it would have to be part of a general mobilization of the knowledge and sort of practical know-how infrastructure of the country, and really just whatever's available to meet these challenges head on, because we're talking about a transition that's just the massive and an absurdly short window if we're gonna even preserve like half the species on the planet Earth.
It kind of reminds me of that. There's that. Do you remember the GM plant in Oshawa? That mm-hmm. was GM and outside that they're mm-hmm. closing the plant, right? And like the workers there actually were like, no, we can use this plant to like make like if the government bought it, we can use this plant to make like we can retool it to make electric vehicles, right?
So exactly.
It's
exactly.
You see, I think you, through that you kind of see this thing you're looking at, where like if you give them the autonomy, the kind of a mandate with more social environmental kind of goals, and their workers are absolutely mm-hmm. incredibly well placed to know how to use their tools and their know-how.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say there aren't challenges to turning things over to the workers and empowering them, but there are also potentially tremendous advantages. Mm-hmm. I mean, workers once they own a factory or once they own a company, even like Bombardier, they're not going to cut 12,000 jobs and give the executives millions in bonuses. That's not something they're going to do, but that is something that Bombardier did mm-hmm. Right after it got, you know, hundreds of millions in subsidies. So that's what prompted the article in the first place, because mm-hmm. That's what they do over and over again mm-hmm. is they, you know, they're totally frivolous with the thing that they're supposed to be providing, you know, jobs, and they're very, very aggressive and greedy when it comes to getting the subsidies. And so I think we could just get better bang for our buck as taxpayers, as governments, representing taxpayers, to say like, okay, let's start some experiments with mm-hmm. worker-owned institutions that have a social mandate, that create open source plans. You know, maybe we're not going to make the most money, but we are going to create knowledge centers. We are going to create secondary industries where people developing, you know, when you have a lot of people working on something and creating knowledge that's useful and circulating that knowledge, especially in that sort of open source paradigm, you are all of a sudden, there's all kinds of businesses that are going to pop up and say, okay, well, we're going to refine this platform and we're going to create this little piece and sell it globally or whatever it is. and
that gets added.
And that can create an explosion of entrepreneurship. So basically, instead of looking at intellectual property as like, in an extractive model where you're trying to, you know, wring the most profit out of it for yourself, you say, okay, no, this is more like a commons. Like, you know, it's like a lake. You don't want a private lake. You want a public lake. And then all kinds of different businesses can happen mm-hmm. there. You have people who set up a marina and do sailing tours. You have people who go fishing and sell the fish. And as long as that's sustainable and you don't deplete the fish stocks, you can keep doing that.
Of course, yeah.
And making
people,
money. And
people
like,
use it responsibly.
Yeah.
It's kind of,
yeah, you sell like
collective harmony.
Yeah. You have a public beach and then you have people who sell ice cream and you have restaurants and all kinds of businesses develop around these sort of commons. And so it's the same idea. Like if you create a really nice open source train design, and then you have people from universities, people from some kind of worker co-op, publicly funded worker co-op, like constantly refining those and working on them and making that the best high-speed train in the world, mm-hmm. or the best set of train designs in the world, then you're going to attract other businesses that are kind of come and like, create variations on that and then sell those, or like provide technical support for the people like implementing that. And, you know, and this is a sort of well-known business model in the open source world, where open source software just makes sense because, you know, the design is better when you have more people working on it and refining it and adding their own.
Our stuff. Own broadcasting software is open source.
Exactly. Yeah. OBS.
Shout out
to OBS.
Open broadcasting software. Our producer's throwing up the sign of the horns.
So I just don't see why we couldn't think outside the box and think, you know, there's enough precedent there to say, okay, that's worth mm-hmm. that's worth throwing $4 billion or $20 billion or even $100 billion into that experiment. And you know, the worst case scenario is you learn a lot and create a lot of useful knowledge that, you know, improves the planet. Like that's the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. The best case scenario is you create a vibrant, you know, local economies and become a, you know, global thought leader. And people from all over the world come and bring their business to you and seek your advice and seek your pay you nice consultant rates and all that stuff.
I think what's interesting is like to continue this kind of like metaphor that you're using about this lake.
Yeah.
I think that's really kind of like telling, because like I think for me at least it evokes this like image of like that I'm very familiar with, right?
Yeah.
Whether I go to like a friend's kind of house on the lake, yeah. There's this kind of sense of like communal responsibility around this lake for
yeah.
the most part, right? Sometimes you might have people who are like too loud who are like maybe. But most times, there's this kind of mm-hmm. desire for harmony that people want around this lake. And I think I really enjoy the idea of kind of thinking about these sorts of like investments or these kind of, maybe not investments, might not be the word, but like these policies that try to create these kinds of lakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, what that makes me think of is like, even when we look at that Airbus strike, this was kind of created around a lake, right? If we consider the lake in question here, Mirabel, right? Because this was like
yeah.
This massive airport that was like,
absolutely, yeah, no.
Plan to like replace.
No, I mean, if you actually start mapping the public subsidies that went into the possibility of mm-hmm. even this thing existing, it's much much bigger than $4 billion. Yeah,
because
you
have this massive like, I mean, people don't know, like Mirabel's is like airport, what, like 45 minutes north of here.
Yeah,
it was supposed to take over
international flights.
Trudeau,
yeah,
because. It's supposed to take over international flights because there's this kind of like dreams of like big growth from metropolis here in Montreal. And obviously that was not the case. It was just kind of like too big. It kind
yep.
of like just completely crashed. But you still obviously like, you still have like the remnants of it. Like you have like the airstrip there.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened is around the lake that is like Mirabel Airport that fell short, incredibly short of like these kinds of aspirations. It's still there, and it provides this kind of function to all these like either like cargo businesses there.
Yeah, it's
like,
an incredible piece of infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly.
That
people still benefit
used,
off
yeah,
of, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Instead of it being this, I find it's sort of like instead of being this kind of common. Lake that you're talking about now, instead it's this lake with sort of like private kind of like concerns, right?
Yeah.
All this to say is like we are creating these lakes. All this to say, like these lakes that you're talking about are kind of being created, but they're not really being
not very thoughtfully and within
exactly.
the sort of, you know, mid-century, previous century paradigms. Yeah. I mean, like the lakes that we invest in are like highways.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that like Quebec is just like never, you know, no province. And no federal government, for that matter, ever met a highway project that it didn't just love to pour money into. And so that's sort of what we're dealing with.
I think this is a perfect segue.
Excellent.
I think this is a perfect. You've presented me with you gave me a great alley-oop to our next topic. Valérie Plante.
Yeah.
Mayor of Montreal. She's concerned, worried about the new Quebec budget for public transportation.
Yeah, as Philip Seymour Hoffman said, we have concerns, dude.
Which one was that in? Big Lebowski? Sometimes you got real specific with some of these quotes. Like these are movies I've seen.
I thought that was pretty universal, but maybe I'm dating my myself generationally here.
That's right. I accept any and all references you make, even if I don't. I'm not there to receive them.
Oh dear.
I'm here to learn.
Millennials and older.
Yeah.
Real heads will know. All right.
Yeah. So here we have. This article in the Global News. I'm worried. Montreal Mayor Valerie Plante raises post-budget transit concerns. So, Valerie Plante didn't have many good things to say about the provincial budget tabled by Quebec's finance minister on Tuesday. She expressed overall disappointment and genuine concern, especially when it comes to public transit funding. I'm worried.
She's worried. I'm worried too. I'll be honest. I share her worry.
I think it's safe to say Metropolis is also worried, Valerie Plante. We're here with you. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, I guess, let's go off that. So I guess there's a couple things here. So the CAC not really providing funding for public transit. I think the funding that is there, the article goes on to say, is incredibly status quo.
Yeah,
so $13 billion over 10 years is status quo, according to, what's this guy's name? He's an expert. Dead air kills me. Grenier, expert for public transit infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, $13 billion over 10 years. It's also like when you look at how, especially going to the point about highways, how we divvy up funding for highways versus public infrastructure, we're actually behind even places like Ontario. Public transportation funding is 70% for public transit. And 30% for highways. We're here in Quebec, it's much more like 50-50.
Right. Yeah, Quebec loves highways. I think we have a cement business in Quebec. I think that exists everywhere, but it just seems like the lobby is a little more robust here, maybe, in terms of its influence. But yeah, I mean, if you just look at the amount of time wasted, much less money and studies and all this stuff, but the amount of time wasted on the Troisième Lien in Quebec City, it's just deeply absurd.
Yeah, so just a recap. Yeah. Troisième Lien was this kind of proposed tunnel, was it? Yeah, it was a tunnel.
I think so.
It was a tunnel kind of connecting the capital, Quebec City, to the suburbs like Lévis.
The mainland, yeah.
Yeah, because right now there's...
Or the South Shore, I should say.
Yeah, because right now there's like two bridges, and they're saying we need a third, but after... Expensive studies. After it was revealed, actually, that at first it was like the CAC wanted to go through with this based on no studies at all, and that's always sort of been this thing. I mean, I'm happy that.
I think the CAC just sort of follows what they think is going to be popular with their sort of suburban base.
Yeah, I mean they're not wrong.
And so we're stuck. Yeah, we're stuck politically with the tyranny of the suburbs, basically. Yeah. That's the sort of fundamental issue. I mean, I think they are particularly obtuse as human beings as well, which doesn't help. Like the sort of like a layered on top of the relationship with the like, you know, the reign of the burbs at the moment.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's also, I think, important to note that we're recording.
It's a laid-back session.
Yeah. Laid-back. I'm chill. I'm so relaxed. My heart rate went up a little bit for that one. But
yeah.
What was I saying? I mean, just go back to the Troisième Lien thing. And this is kind of... It is a little past the point, but like just to drive the point home. To drive it home, in fact. Adding lanes to highways, widening roads to make room for more cars does not reduce congestion. I think that's like... This idea that, like, I think people have as like drivers, as like the suburban drivers have, like, if only there was one more lane, then there'd be no traffic. I mean, look at places like LA, like massive, like 16 like lane highways, and it's also there's so much their own kind of like policy that's going on, but like more lanes doesn't do anything. It's called induced demand. You add more lanes, they get filled up because that's just how it works, you know.
It would seem. I was going to do another Big Lebowski reference.
Let's go.
We know this, dude.
We know.
we do know this.
I mean,
sorry, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to ask you about that, because I feel like this kind of connects to our last discussion, right, about how, like, if we're talking about how the money is used for moving around, you have, like, $1.3 billion being put into medium-sized planes for these multinational companies that, or they might serve Quebec a little bit, but the goal isn't really, it doesn't have this kind of like social goal, right? And I guess, and here we are hearing about Valerie Plante being concerned about the lack of funding. And I guess to me, it just it just shows the difference.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's the CAC. The CAC doesn't have any seats in Montreal, or if they do,
they have one.
They have one.
One right on the tip of the island.
There you go. So the CAC has one seat in Montreal. So that there you go. And you know, I guess that's why they support the REM de l'Est, which is you know, again, with the obtuseness and with the sort of like corporate capture, you know, the REM is of course a privatization project, which is funneling money. And Valerie Plante is not blameless. I mean, she came in as the REM was just, you know, getting its putting shovels down basically, and didn't say a word about it. But that project exists to siphon money out of Montreal's, you know, transit system.
Yeah. It kind of took the. It also takes like a lot of support away from her Pink Line kind of like
exactly.
transit dream as well, right?
Yeah. So now we're what, 6 years into, you know, 7 years into Plante's mandate, or second mandate. Sorry, into her mayoralty, and we're, you know, basically we're seeing, you know, metro stations close at 11 p.m. while the police get $100 million extra a year to do God knows what with. And so, yeah, this is the situation that we're in. And meanwhile, you mentioned the Pink Line. I mean, it was a bold and interesting proposal coming out of the gates. It got no traction with the CAC again because it didn't please any of their constituencies that they wanted to like reward. But they did get like a little tramway, I think, along Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And so they said, oh, that's the first, they sort of claimed that as a victory for the REM. But apparently there's an office with like six full-time people working round the clock on the, not round the clock, but like, you know, full time on,
that was very generous.
On trying to create the, we're working round the clock on the REM. On the REM, on the Pink Line. That has not seemed to, those six people don't seem to have made too much headway except these little tiny things that they're sort of claiming are the Pink Line. And then we have the REM de l'Est, which is just going to siphon even more money out of the public coffers, not for any public benefit, just for private profit. But also, you know, not provide like the, you know, there's a group called Transparence, Transparence, like basically transparency, but with train, trains. At the beginning.
Transparent train.
But it's a local group that was sort of agitating against the REM for a long time for this specific reason. And they had an alternate plan where it was like, okay, we actually invest the same amount of money and like actually create comprehensive bus service in the east of the island and light rail along existing rights of way and so on, you know, without submerging it or putting it above ground, which it takes just gigantic amounts of concrete, which sets back by decades, like any kind of carbon neutrality. So the Pink Line, never got off the ground because LEGO, you know, wasn't interested. The feds, the Trudeau government wasn't interested. They put money into the REM because that they just love privatization. Yeah. They love it. Even though it provides less service for more money and, you know, doesn't actually, you know, meet your urban planning goals and instead
it's also been rife creating
like, real estate value increases instead of actually serving people.
REM is like a light rail project. It's been rife with like so many delays. Like I've heard about like hour long delays, which is like,
right.
I think it's kind of like, inherent in like just the design of it compared to like something like underground. Right. But I guess it being underground might use up more or might cost more concrete or what I'm kind of curious about that point.
I don't know about underground, but above ground takes a huge amount of concrete.
And
REM is mostly above ground. It's because you have to build these gigantic, you know, you basically just have to build a new ground in the sky to like run your train on.
Right.
The amount of concrete. That's friendly to the Quebec concrete business. They love it. We love our concrete.
We're gonna, if the show's canceled, it's gonna be because of them.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be found in a hotel room. And it's gonna
concrete boots for anybody who opposes the concrete industry. So, yeah.
Like, you called him? I'm like, yeah. It's like, the concrete business sends its regards, and bam!
Oh, dear.
No. Anyway, I mean, it's interesting because it's like...
Surely we just.
Okay, they're going to write songs about me. I think it's interesting because, like, I'm reading this right here. It's like the Pink Line was said to be finished next year.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think it hits like another kind of tone of like this alternative history, right? Of like, yeah. we see this kind of like very bold, ambitious project. Of course, there's some people who are kind of like always skeptical about it from the beginning, not from the sense that it was something that shouldn't be done, but rather of like, this is a kind of big pie in the sky dream that like maybe Pleasure Knows will kind of rile up Montrealers and be the final kind of nail in the coffin for Coderre. And it sort of was, right? I think it was an incredibly inspiring thing to see this. And like,
yeah, you can make the case that she won that election because of the Pink Line.
I will. I thought it was just incredibly like activating thing that I think people want from politics, right? This kind of like big goals, aspirational, fundamental changes to how our society, our city is laid out. That
and it should be said, it's a fundamentally positive vision. I mean, a efficient, publicly owned, you know, new transit line, something we haven't done in decades.
That would serve kind of areas that are like underserved, mostly like kind of poor, much more working class than especially the REM line, right? If we look at like the neighborhoods that the REM serves, is much more of the areas that have already been gentrified. They're undergoing like very like heavy, classic like big apartment building developments, or some like suburban areas. Not to say that, of course, these areas don't deserve public transit, but like it is, I think, a clear. It is very telling when you see who the Pink Line would have served and who the REM serves, and which one kind of ended up getting more money. I think it shows sort of what the system does.
Absolutely.
Anything to add to that before we hop on to our last topic
here? Yeah, I mean, I just think it's a minor tragedy for sure. I do feel like, I don't know, I just have, just given how sort of milquetoast PM has been and taking on the other levels of government on other topics, I have to imagine that there was more pressure that could have been applied, or more, you know, you create situations, it's more political maneuvering that could have been put into service of getting something like the Pink Line happening, especially at the federal level. I mean, this is this is a completely within, you know, liberal rhetoric, and with two consecutive liberal NDP, minority, NDP-backed liberal minorities. Like, it's just hard for me to imagine that there wasn't a way to get this done, to get like whatever, however many, 20 billion or whatever you need, or 10 billion.
For the Pink Line?
Yeah.
The initial estimates were around seven
billion. Okay. Yeah. You know, with
it's like we're
with,
dumping 1.5 into
with
like
the anticipated cost overruns. Let's call it an even 10. But of course. I mean, the REM started out at 5.5, I think, and now it's 8.
A guy told me it would cost $2, and he would do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the initial quote before we run into some cost overrun issues, some delays, some inflation.
Nice dinners.
Yeah, some nice dinners. Yeah. Exactly. So
I think there's something interesting to be said there. Maybe this might
I mean, what are these six people? I want to know what these six people have been doing for 7 years. I mean, I'm really curious. Yeah. Or 6 years.
Like, hey, how's it going? So late.
Yeah.
What's up?
Yeah, we should go. We should go into the Pink Line office with a camera and hey, how's it going?
Hey, I hear it's bring your son to work day. My dad works here. They're like, no, he doesn't.
So what do you guys do? What are you guys doing here anyway? What's going on? Six people. I mean, I don't know. I feel like if I had a six-person advocacy team working for 6 years,
I
have to imagine that we could get some stuff done. You know,
this is all right. That's a pitch. That's a pitch for me and Drew, I guess. If you guys are looking for two
guns for hire here.
If you guys need two more people at that Pink Line office, make it a nice 9. I mean, let's kind of like before we get into the next topic, I do think there's something interesting you're touching upon here about the kind of like, if we're talking about like political world power, right, of like parties. And I think when you're talking about like how PM was sort of had this like really strong mandate from their like first like election when they unseated Coderre, with this sort of like goal, the stream of like this incredibly beneficial project of and beneficial, potentially intimidating, right? I would imagine for like any kind of political party. And they didn't, clearly the willpower they had, whatever, enough kind of opposition from the province from the feds. And you kind of see this a lot in municipal circles where people will say, oh, you know, our hands are tied. You know, we can only do so much. And I kind of wonder, like, to me, I'm starting to think about just, like, in terms of, like, who these people are, what kind of material lives they live, and how their relationship to the idea of, like, political leverage, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that they have much access to whatever, like, experience would give them a better knowledge of, like, or even, like, a bigger appetite of what can be done politically, yeah. right? Because it's, like, for them, it's, like, we tried, whatever. There's not, like, for them, maybe there's not much at stake. They can kind of go back to, like, falling on, like, resting on their laurels, going on to, like, more, like, smaller projects and stuff like that. But I kind of wonder what it would take for a municipal party, at least, to have that kind of political world power. Because I think there's been talk, I've, like, spoken to some people who've worked in municipal politics. You know, like, if you compare it to, like, other kind of, like, I don't know, like, any kind of, like, civic organization, like, something like a, like, I mean, a union is kind of easy to.
No, I get where you're coming at. I mean, I feel like ultimately it's about having a mobilized base. And the problem with something like Projet Montréal is,
I don't think the race is a mobilizing type.
No, they're not mobilizing. They're, I mean, and I would even go further and say that, you know, the fundamental paradigm of, like, social democratic functioning is to demobilize your base. Because otherwise you are going to be squeezed between a rock and a hard place, in the sense that you have, if you create an unmovable force in this form of a social movement, and then you have an immovable object in the form of, like, how real estate developers, segue alert, or transit privatizers, or, you know, other sort of capital interests, then you're going to be the one who's squeezed between those two things. Like you know, the capital's here, social movement's here, and the politicians are right in the middle.
So
you have an inherent interest in sort of, like, turning, you know, like, pushing back the movements, because you know these things are unmovable, or at least you think they are.
And everything,
you're conditioned to believe that that's an immovable object, and that's the sort of people that you're getting pressure from. You know, they own the media, and so they're constant, you know, as soon as you come into office, they're going to be, like, hammering you with all kinds of negative press. I mean, how many front page stories did we see about the, you know,
Camille Oud?
Camille Oud.
Yeah, so that's the,
like,
road that
it was
goes.
Just like weeks of this when they first elected in 2017. It was just, like, nonstop, like, you know, complaining about PM, and it's just like, at a certain point you're like, stop, you know, you're gonna say uncle at a certain point. It really takes people who are committed and want to fight,
to
be
in power.
And I don't think Valérie Plante is, you know, she wants to be the, like, stylish, progressive, you know, affable and charismatic mayor of Montreal. She doesn't want to fight capital
tooth and nail.
To the extent that there's a win-win, she'll take it, but otherwise, you know, we'll leave the rest on the table there. Somebody else can do that. I think social movements weren't organized or disciplined enough we didn't even have any kind of media saying, like, okay, well, here's what we need to do as people to, like, get the most out of this. Just nothing.
It's a different approach to
And there wasn't even any sort of, like, coherent critique. I think there were some attempts to do it, you know, laudable attempts to try to create that kind of infrastructure, but it just kind of went nowhere. We just have PM, you know, Projet Montréal, flying solo and sort of trying to make deals to maintain their sort of progressive cred where they can, but without any leverage. And here we are. We don't have any. I don't know. I feel like unions haven't really stepped up, you know, and there's.
Like, on the municipal front, you're saying?
Yeah, any front, honestly.
Other than, like, their, like, workplaces, or
they'll do some bargaining if their membership holds them to that. Even maybe they won't even do it if they don't. You know, because they're in the same sort of, you know, social democratic position. It's just easier to kind of go along to get along, unless there's some kind of strong, persistent mandate from below. I think you see the same dynamic playing out over and over again. And so it's like, okay, the question is, what are those sort of independent social institutions that can that can maintain and apply that pressure. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's an open question. We don't, we haven't invented that yet.
Let me know. Let me know if you have an idea for that. Open source it.
Yeah. Sound off in the chat.
I think there's something that kind of, there's a comment you made to me like way back when we first met, when we were organizing and Encourage.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I had a question about like, oh, what do we do? Like, what do we do if you get like one of our people elected and you're like, then you immediately the day after you're like protesting against them or something to that effect. Keep the pressure on.
Not quite, but yeah. I mean, if you get one person, like if you get a government elected, yeah, I think you have to protest. Not against them, but certainly very directly for the things that you want them to do. And, you know, hold them accountable. You can't demobilize at that point. And I think that's what happens in whatever context this is, you know, when we elect a slightly more progressive, like, you know, people were like, you know, even when Biden was elected, like people were partying in the streets, or like when Trudeau was elected for that matter. People were, there was just a
jubilation,
a gigantic sigh of relief, and then people were like, okay, now I can tune out. But it's like, no, that's the, if you actually believe in any of the things, you know, that he is promising, that is the exact moment when you have to step it up a notch and be like, okay, we're going to put extra pressure and be extra mobilized against, you know, to overcome the obstacles that are going to be put in the way of any kind of, you know, climate agenda or social agenda or wealth redistribution. Like, you're going to have to deal with all that stuff.
There's something so I'm going to get way too, like, I'm too deep in the mud here, but I think there's something so, like, fundamentally different about that, about the kind of mindset about, like, having a politician, electing a politician, and then assuming that, like, okay, my job's done. Now it's time for them to take over. You know, it's like, I don't have to worry about this anymore. To me, it's something like, it's something akin to like having like you call the plumber. Plumber comes over. It's like, all right, the plumber's here now. I'm going to let them do the job. You know, I think there's something so, we wash our hands of that kind of like, of political tasks. We kind of let politicians take up that kind of like work. I think without any kind of intervention from our end, it's a little too easily.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still in sort of a hangover from the welfare state as well, like in the sense that, like, you know, there were so many concessions made at the in the last century, especially in the 30s and 40s, you know, going into the 60s and 70s maybe, you know, like, and we got all these things and we sort of forgot the history of, like, how much militant action and how much, like, literal threat of seizure of power it took to get public health care, to get, you know, all the institutions that we sort of, you know, that were sort of just multiple generations into just having as the sort of, I don't know, tapestry or backdrop that we're dealing with, you know, of our daily lives, whether it's the CBC or the NFP or like unemployment insurance, like all those things people were like literally fought and died for, you know, to a certain extent, in the sense, that you're fighting with cops in the streets and having big like strikes where there's like existential stakes.
Yeah, it's a real struggle. You
know? Real struggle. And I think we're just so far away from that. And the very unfortunate thing is things have had to get this bad, and which isn't to say that they can't get much, much worse for us to start to like have that, feel like there's some existential stakes, which is unfortunately seems to be the thing that gives those movements the ability to achieve those things.
Activation.
Yeah.
That was an interesting thing about like power. People's like kind of like, I guess, imaginations of power, and I guess how it's been, like, we're talking about the histories of how people actively use their power and whatever it means.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of strikes, showing up, whatever, like, there's so many ways that power kind of like exudes itself from like this kind of ground up kind of way, and how those histories have been either forgotten or I think a lot of times like kind of like purposefully like ignored or whatever, so that's kind of that idea of like how much power people actually have is kind of hidden away, but it does seem to be people are kind of grasping for it, searching for it.
I mean, it's a real conundrum. I feel like I've really spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, how do you actually mobilize power when people don't feel those existential stakes and people are sort of still a little bit comfortable.
Yeah, I've spoken to organizer friends about that's like, I think this is one of the more like cynical thoughts I have about like, I think do people only get activated when things get bad? You know, is it even possible for like, let's say in like the good times for people to feel that kind of like willpower, like political, activation?
I think it is possible, but it's like, you know, the things that you can sort of see it in things that are relatively that are like established sort of, I don't know, cultural structures like war, you know, war will get people fired up, even if
rallied around the flag,
and they're willing to, like, to the extent that they're willing to sacrifice their lives. I mean, that's like, and often for just absurdly corrupt causes, but it works, you know. And so, you know, the question is, you know, as people who don't want to go kill people and actually want to make people's lives better, like, how do we find things that have that feeling of existential stakes, have that. You know, it's an unanswered question, but I think it's something we're constantly sort of searching for.
And I think just to wrap this all up, I think this is all to say that I don't believe that, like, the people in PM have that kind of, like, political will, or that it's clearly lacking from our elected officials.
Yeah.
And not to say that they don't have good intentions, not to say they haven't done good work, but I think, to me, it's not even just PM, right? I find that's a kind of a common thing among a lot of parties, and that is just something about that structure that's sort of built into it.
Speaking of which, should we talk about another way in which
go ahead, you can do the segue now.
Another way in which you know, nascent movements haven't been able to access those existential stakes, even though they're very present for, you know, millions of people in our city.
Yeah, so we're talking about St. Viateur bagels now.
Yeah,
I'm just kidding. Yeah, so we are talking, before you mentioned, you gave a little segue alert. We're talking, the city of Montreal, they decided there's a certain kind of guy that deserves a break. A certain kind of figure that...
Just imagine.
Life's been too hard for them.
Imagine all the people in Montreal, and just imagine the person who needs a break more than anybody. And...
Real estate and developers.
Exactly.
All right. So before on the show, we've kind of talked
about... They work so hard for us, and now that we just want them to enjoy their life a little bit.
Who else will build a big, ugly condo building with an A&W at the bottom of it, you know?
I mean, open question.
Another open question.
We're throwing down the gauntlet here. I mean, who else is going to do that? Yeah. I mean, there's nobody else will do it.
All right. So on the show in the past, we've had episodes where we talk about this sort of fund that the city has that's supposed to go towards public, social, affordable housing. One way that this fund works is that developers are told, hey, if you're a developer now. Hey, Drew, so you want to build this big, ugly building in this neighborhood? We're going to let you do that, obviously. Mm-hmm. Obviously, none of having a big, ugly building that is going to be too expensive, and that
each balcony is going to have a nice sheet of concrete on the bottom, and then nice four glass.
Never use it.
and nobody, you'll never see anybody on it.
Yes. Oh, I think I made the point that these condos kind of remind me of Norwegian prisons in the previous episode. Anyways, so you're building this building, but I'm like, I know me as the whatever city worker, not city worker, a Projet Montréal administrator. I'm like, I was about to swear, there's a housing crisis. And then look at you, and I'm like, okay, but this developer might be able to help me. Mm. Instead of applying any kind of pressure, I'm like, hey, by the way, just like very timidly, like, hey, if you want to build some affordable housing, social housing in your building, I'd kind of love that.
Pretty please.
Pretty please.
With sugar on top, yeah.
But it's like, it's cool. if not, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, if not, no worries.
Yeah, if not, no worries. Essentially.
It's chill.
The if not, no worries is just like like a few thousand dollars, essentially.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
$3,000 to $4,000 of like, I'm not going to, you're saying I'm not going to build that, but here's some money for the if not, no worries fund. They're taking that away now.
Yeah.
After
many years of real estate developers doing nothing.
Yeah. I think
they're now being given a break from doing nothing.
Exactly. Since 2021, this sort of if not, no worries fund has existed. Where developers could kind of back out of even like the non-existent pressure to build social and affordable housing. It was also shown that none of them chose that option. No one chose to build it. They all chose to pay the nominal fee. Sorry, maybe next time.
Yeah.
The city has, since 2021, I do believe the city has gone, I have the figure right here, $38.7 million from it. But
enough to build like one apartment building. Or
exactly.
Something.
Yeah. So I think only one building has really come out of that. I'm not sure what the figure is for how many have been built. Mm-hmm. But now that funding is going to be going away. The city is giving the developers a break for 2 years, they're saying, and after 2 years, they're going to, in a staggered kind of way, bring that funding back.
Yeah.
Bring that kind of option back to pay the fine, but... Two years without this. What do you think?
I think this just comes back to the essence of the Valerie Plante approach to politics. It's like, okay, if it's the if not no worries approach, it's like we're not gonna we know from the outset that we're not gonna like confront or like create any conflict with capital like interest. That's just a foregone conclusion. And so, what are we gonna do? We're gonna keep increasing the police budget. We're gonna cut the transit budget, and we're gonna let landlords off the hook for their, you know, very meager sort of social housing, you know, requirements, mm-hmm. and hope for the best. So that I don't, you know, spoiler alert, I don't think that that's going to be enough to address the profound housing crisis that we're facing.
The roots of that go so deep.
Yeah, it's not even going to scratch the surface. So this is where we're at. And, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, the movements have applied enough. I mean, the movements are not non-existent. I mean, there people were protesting, you know, weekly, at a certain point, against the CACs, you know, housing,
the lease transfer one,
yeah, where they gutted the lease transfer and did a bunch of other pro landlord stuff. You know, there were like weekly protests against that. So it's not nothing, but again, I feel like you know, housing people see Valerie Plante and PM as a sort of an ally of sorts, and so they get let off the hook a lot, mm-hmm. because you know it's in the same way that the Democrats in the U.S. get let off the hook.
You know, the lesser evil, or the
all my like boomer friends, I guess, you know, my parents' friends basically on Facebook are like posting all these like pro Biden memes, and it's mm-hmm. just and every once in a while will be like, he's supporting a genocide right now. But the logic is there. It's like, okay, is Trump going to be worse on a lot of different fronts? Yes, he will. Mm-hmm. And so here's our baseline, you know, mm-hmm. here's what we have to glorify mm-hmm. in order to keep Trump from coming in. Mm-hmm. And that literally includes, you know, starving a million kids. Mm-hmm. If that, so it is, you know, and so, you know, the much like Valerie Plante, to her credit, is not starving a million kids. I will give her that. It's the same dynamic, though.
Yeah,
you know,
It's not at the scale. And even among president, but it's at like this. It's of course our local scale with this.
Yeah, even among activists. And so, yeah, for 7 years, we've been there hasn't been any kind of critical mass of like, okay, here's an alternative way to approach this mm-hmm. Projet Montréal, and here's what we want you to do. Mm-hmm. Like that has not happened, which is shocking to me, honestly. Like it's shocking that nobody has gotten it together to say like. In a concerted way, you know, here's what Projet Montréal should be doing, even in the absence of good federal or provincial policy. I think mostly they've just been focused on the federal and provincial, like trying to stave off the worst from those places. And I think I think honestly it's a missed opportunity, because I think Projet Montréal does have a lot of people in it who are sympathetic and who could become mobilized if some pressure was applied, if there was a framework and an alternative vision. But that just hasn't happened. I mean, I think people sort of just passively accepted that the 2020 thing sounded good. I mean, there was almost no critical discourse about it. It's a little bit shocking to me that like, people just don't talk about it one way or the other. It's just mm-hmm. kind of like it's just exists.
Cool, see how this works.
Yeah. And they'll blast Lego and they'll organize demonstrations about it. But yeah, I would have liked to see a little more of an engagement at the municipal level, because I think there is a lot that could have been different over the last 6 years. But, you know, lost opportunities.
People have been sort of, I guess, I don't know about satisfied, but maybe put off by the idea that, oh, it could be worse, and then maybe they mm-hmm. don't mobilize against for that kind of reason.
I mean, we have a year left before, you know, Projet Montréal may well get kicked out of office. Might not. Maybe she'll get 3 terms. But, you know, dissatisfaction is going to you know, presiding over a housing crisis and emptying out of the downtown, an increase in the police budget, and you know, a decline of the transit system, when those are your central issues, you know, that is going to catch up to you electorally eventually.
Yeah. It feels like there's such a like you're saying, this missed opportunity for, I guess, to mobilize against this kind of force of like real estate profiteers, right? Yeah. That seems like something that like Projet and like Godet are sort of like still on the same page. Maybe not exactly on the same page on. I think Projet does sort of like gesture towards these kinds of solutions, but like it's like crumbs, right? And I think with this story, it's like, I think I want to say it's good to see them trying, but honestly, at this point, that thing was like crumbs, right? It doesn't even come close to even like solving anything. And then it's like the audacity to take the crumbs away too, you know? It's like, oh, I was like, hey, by the way, I'm kind of hungry for like housing solutions. Like, oh, here, have some, like, have a cracker. And I'm like, oh, I guess. But then they take the cracker away. You know, it's like it's kind of like insulting, but it's insulting, I guess, to this kind of like base that they might have in people like me, who kind of want to see these kinds of housing solutions, right? People like you, people like our viewers as well. It is kind of this naked. I do find this giving them a break is like, oh man, that's just like what a move. But it is, I do find there's like this kind of honesty in it. You know, there's this kind of like clearly like they're just showing like we're not gonna even try. Yeah. They're showing where they're kind of like where their efforts are, and it is absolutely not on any kind of development front. I think sometimes I hear words about like them developing some kind of like landlord license thing that could sort of be here, but that's mostly like a provincial thing. It's completely like I feel like landlords and
I think we should be clear what the policy alternatives are. Like, I mean, you can like the municipal government does have the power to tax property values, and they could tax the increases in property values at 100%, and you know, basically make like to remove the incentive for housing speculation, and then plow that money back into social housing and create their own housing fund. Like, those are all things that are under their control, but the political cost of doing so is just perceived to be too high. You know, and also social movements haven't really asked for that. Yeah. Like, nobody's put a coherent case together and said, okay, here's what we want Projet Montréal to do, or even like, here's what we want the progressive wing of Projet Montréal to do. Like, it just hasn't happened. So it's a little shocking, but here's where we are, you know, 6 years in.
Yeah, completely demobilized on the municipal front.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it for today's conversation, Drew. Thank you very much for joining me. So folks enjoyed the laid back episode touched upon.
Yeah.
Laid back episode. Talk about the Mirabel airman strike. Talked about Valerie Plante being disappointed, worried. I think the disappointment might be ours after that last conversation.
we are ending it on a bit of a grim note, but you know, can't have happy endings every episode.
No, but I mean,
tune in next week for a potentially different ending. We'll see.
It doesn't have to be a happy ending, but it's just kind of like, hopefully our listeners listen to this and they're like, damn, things could be better.
Yeah, I'm ready to get mobilized.
Let's get mobilized.
I'm pumped. Let's do it.
All right, folks. Thank you very much for listening to our laid back episode. Thank you, Drew, for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Till next time.